Hello, it's been a while, but we are returning with a special edition of the Bruin podcast. And this follows a fascinating discussion with one of the best-selling authors of a series of books that inform us about the factors determining geopolitical events. And the best known of these books is Prisoners of Geography. And the author is Tim Marshall. So this is obviously right at the top of investors' agendas right now, but bear in mind, it is not investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. Also, please remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance differ from that of the past. So let's get on with discussing the changing political landscape with Tim. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the Bruin podcast. We are going to be covering matters geopolitical. There really is nothing else of greater importance to cover at the moment. But we are extremely grateful to have with us to discuss geopolitics, Tim Marshall, who many will know is a journalist, broadcaster, and best-selling author who's written and reported widely on foreign affairs and international diplomacy. He has been a reporter for the BBC and Sky before writing a number of excellent books, probably the best known for Prisoners of Geography, which has become an international bestseller. And Tim, thank you very much, first of all, for
joining us.
And I think to people who have read Prisoners of Geography, the unfolding crisis in Ukraine will be providing a sort of deja vu like feelings, because it was say not explicitly predicted, but sort of motivations behind it are really laid out quite brilliantly in Prisoners of Geography. So I wonder if you could sort of just give us a brief summary of what it is about the Ukraine that is of such enormous relevance to Russia.
Thank you for your kind words. It is one of those strange occasions where you are not happy to be partially right, because it has played out pretty much along the lines I thought it would. And I don't take any great credit for being able to see into the future. It's one of those. Russia is the best example that I have of how geography is one of the determining factors in what happens, and how you can forecast scenarios with a reasonable amount of confidence. Because if you do know the topography, the geography, and then the history that flowed from it, and then you know the current set of political values, you know that, okay, these are the options and these are not options. I mean, politically, we all can work out it is not an option for Putin to lose. You know, it's not like in a democracy where you lose a war and you get voted out. You can well end up dead in that sort of culture. But yeah, sorry, to answer your question, Prisoners of Geography pointed out that Russia has continually been invaded from the West, and that to get to it, usually you don't go over the mountains, the Carpathians, and you don't go over the sea, the Baltic, you go through the gap between the two, which is Poland. It's flat ground, it's the North European plain. And once you're through it, it opens up into this huge, almost 1,000 kilometers of flat ground, which is Belarus and Ukraine, which is in front of Moscow and St. Petersburg. So although we are no threat to Russia, you have to understand why they might think you are. We are. And so consequently, they always seek to plug the gap, Poland, or if not, to dominate the flat ground, Belarus and Ukraine. And so when Ukraine decides it has no wish to be in their sphere of influence anymore, they get nervous. And so when you know that, and you know that history and geography, you know, it's not rocket science to then formulate some scenarios that they intend to do something about this. And I argued strongly that after 2014, that was not the end of it, and they would be coming back for another bite.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book as well is this, the importance of access to water and access to water all year round. So how does that play into that?
That's the second part of it. The first part, and I think mostly the dominant part, is that flat ground, because that's what they see as a threat. What they see as an opportunity is to project their power outwards in a naval manner. You know, to this day, you cannot be a global power without having a strong navy. And the Americans and the British before them proved it. But their ports in the north, one or two of them freeze. All of them during the winter, you have to get through the ice pack. They don't have a warm water port, but they were renting one. It was in the Black Sea. It was in a place called Crimea and Sevastopol, which was part of Ukraine, legally still is part of Ukraine. So again, after 2014 and the overthrow of the pro-Russian government, when the president fled, it doesn't take much imagination to game out the future. Russia will either spend the next few years agitating unrest in the Crimea in order to give it an excuse or even to create militias that will overthrow the local government, or it will actually invade. The third option of doing nothing wasn't an option. So when you know those two scenarios, and that's what I was expecting to happen. And yeah, you know, again, you know, it doesn't mean I've got a crystal ball. It means that you look at the variables and you can make educated guesses about what's going to happen.
One of the things I know you talked about is like the realignment of different countries now that there's now that the tensions between NATO and the West and Russia has sort of flared up. And you talk a bit about Turkey's role in that, which first of all, maybe I could ask you to expand on that, but I suppose it kind of draws into question, I suppose, like what the real value of a Black Sea port is. Yes. Yeah,
in shorthand, again, when you know the terrain and you know, you just look at the map and you see the Black Sea and there's the Bosphorus, which Turkey controls, and Turkey, and then you go onto the history. And Turkey and Russia have a lot of history between them. Then superimpose the ill discipline of the multipolar world, by which I mean after the Cold War, even a NATO power such as Turkey decides it can gamble a bit, push a bit, because during the Cold War, there's no way a NATO power would have bought its weapon systems from Moscow. But that's what Turkey did after the Cold War a few years ago, because it's a multipolar world and everyone's pushing around. And I argue that they were sliding out of NATO. And one of the many things about this year and why it's a watershed is that the invasion of Ukraine has actually probably, almost certainly, halted that slide. Why? Because the old contours of geography and history suddenly come back into focus. And you remember, there's Turkey, there's the Black Sea, there's the Russians. And you remember their history. So what's Turkey going to do now when it sees the limits, well, the limits that Russia is prepared to go to gain territory? Well, you can continue sliding out of NATO and try and do it on your own, or you can think, maybe we've pushed this as far as we can. And that's why I'm predicting that the slide out of NATO has finished, and that Turkey will at the very least remain in NATO and probably start thinking and asking, you know, we really perhaps ought to reinforce the fleet around the Black Sea area, don't you think? And that sort of thing, you know, and it is predicated, Guy, on this, you know, an understanding of the past and an understanding of the terrain.
So does that mean that there's no path then to, I suppose that, how important is it then to Russia? It can have this, it seems like it's got a shot at having a permanent port in the Black Sea, but it's always going to have to navigate the Bosphorus if it wants to go any further than that. So what's the merit of that?
I won't get too bogged down in detail, but you're right about the Bosphorus, because Treaty of the Montreux Convention, 1936, says that at a time of war, you have to ask Turkey for permission to go through it if you're a warship. And they currently closed it because of that. Unless you're from the Black Sea Fleet, you're not allowed, a Russian ship is not allowed, warship is not allowed in. You know, one that was outside can go home, but they're not allowed, for example, to take the Baltic Fleet, sail it round and put it in there. So yeah, you're right. Is that a limited use? Yes and no. Because ensuring you have your warm water port, you have your 365 days a year naval power in the Black Sea, which is very important to Russia. Again, you look back through its history, but also at times not of war, or if Turkey wasn't if it wasn't NATO, Turkey would not close the Bosphorus, and consequently, Russia can, and this is what it did in the Syria war, It came out of the Black Sea through the Bosphorus and then down and towards the Syrian coastline in the Med when it was fighting in Syria. So it's very, very useful to them to have this port that they can operate from 365 days a year. I'd go on to say, just because this is current, it's also why they covet Odessa so much. If they can come along to Odessa and the Black Sea coast, A, that at that point they would have cut Ukraine off from the sea. That would make it primarily an agrarian economy because they've lost the heavy industry in the Donbass. And then it would be a quick jumping off point to get to Moldova, where they have troops, as you know, in Transnistria. So all this stuff is predicated on looking at the map. Now, it doesn't have to be this way. This is why it's not completely deterministic. Putin could wake up tomorrow and think, you know what, I'm actually a liberal Democrat. I believe in this, that, and the other. I'm anti-war. I'm a pacifist. And here's my new plans. You know, it doesn't have to be that way, but he's not going to do that. He's going to wake up with the same headset, but that headset has been created by the geography and the history that preceded him.
And to the west of Moldova, that is that's beyond that. There's nothing further beyond to that direction for Putin.
That's the limit, because next door is Romania. And like every single other country that was in the Warsaw Pact, the moment they could escape the clutches of Moscow, they did and voted in governments that wanted to join NATO. And they're in NATO, covered by the Defence Pact. Moldova isn't, and at the moment is feeling so nervous, probably wishes it would. So just as we are not prepared to fight overtly, I believe it is a proxy war, but we are not prepared to commit to fighting in Ukraine, because then we would be fighting Russia. Ditto, I don't think we would commit to fighting for Moldova. So if the Russians did try it, you would see a similar response. We would attempt to bolster Moldova's defences, although I think in that particular example, it wouldn't be successful. They've only got 3,500 troops. They're basically a police force. And the Russians, for all their incredible ineptitude. I was looking at some stuff the other day, some photos. It was of one of their armored vehicles, like our warriors, and looked at the tires, which were punctured. And someone had done a close up on the tires, and it said, made in the USSR. They're using 30 year old tires to try and fight a war. Sorry, that was an aside. Despite that, Moldova would not be Ukraine. It would be easier for them.
And you discussed a bit about the sort of sphere of influence of NATO and who's in NATO, who's not in NATO. Obviously very topical at the moment, because we could be on a wave, on the crest or the cusp of a wave of new entrant or new entrants into NATO. So, I mean, if you could get your crystal ball out and tell us who you think might be.
Okay. Tell me when the podcast goes out.
Next week.
Ah.
Yeah, 1 week's time, yeah.
Right. Well, that means we are now talking approximately around the 9th of May. The Russian celebratory parade through Red Square, where Putin will undoubtedly say something. Now, I don't have the crystal ball to know what he's going to say, but let me have a crystal ball of what he might have said by now. He might use that opportunity, because it's 3 days before when Finland and Sweden may make their declarations that they want to join, around about the 12th. There may be all sorts of coded warnings, as in, you really don't want to do that, especially to Finland. Because, you know, they can be major players. Again, look at the map and you'll see why. And you look at where the main Russian fleet is, the northern fleet is, it's virtually next to Finland. So I think we'll see rumblings to try to dissuade them from what would be quite a decision to make, joining NATO. We will see some sort of declarations of a victory. We have saved the good people of Mariupol, but it's a bit like the old Vietnam thing. We had to destroy the village in order to save it. We have liberated Mariupol, they will say. There'll be various claims of successes. But that's about as far as I can go. I think even if there are these warnings to Finland and NATO, I think the die is more or less cast. Public opinion has reversed. They've always been nervous for very understandable reasons. I mean, Sweden saved themselves in World War II by being neutral. Finland suffered terribly twice in the last century at the hands of the Russians and have always tried to be non-aligned. But things have got so far. This is one of Putin's ridiculous Pyrrhic victories. They've gone so far now that public opinion has completely changed and now seriously supports joining. So I think they'll join, and then we will find out at the NATO, well, maybe prior to the NATO summit, which I think from memory is at the end of June. Is it in Lisbon? It's in the Iberian Peninsula somewhere. They may get fast-tracked. They may get fast-tracked, you know, not have to wait these 2 or 3 years or whatever that sometimes you have to. So that is the opposite of what Putin attempted to achieve. I've argued for more than a decade he is a strategist. People always said he's just a tactician. I've always argued he's both. But now I still believe he's a strategist. I just don't think he's quite as good as he thought he was.
You will know of the theory that aside from just the geography, which you describe as one of the factors behind this invasion, another part of the theory is that it was the previous expansion of NATO that kind of forced Putin's hand to some extent. So, I mean, do you agree with that?
Yes.
And do you consider it to have been a mistake?
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting you put it that there's two questions, aren't there? Yes, I do agree that it was a factor. No, I don't think it was a mistake. Because to argue that it was a mistake is to argue that there is no such thing as the collective family of European nations that live in peace and prosperity with each other and agree to go to each other's defense. NATO is absolutely a defensive organization. The only way it goes to war is if it triggers Article 5, that there has been an attack on one of us. So it's, you know, it's not a threat. But this is where we started. This is why the Russians think. Because of their history, because of the terrain, I completely understand that they got increasingly nervous when the NATO powers got within 100 miles of St. Petersburg. But I don't agree that it was a mistake, because do we, and I think this is actually proven what would have probably happened if we had not joined our fellow Europeans in this common European family and allowed them into our exclusive club. Do you really think that by now Putin wouldn't be in Estonia? Why not? What would stop him? Given that he's invaded a country of 50 million people, what would have stopped him invading a country of, I think it's about 2 million, right on his border? You know, which again, with a relatively tiny army, ditto Lithuania, ditto, well, the Baltic states in general. And that's what would have happened. Did we really want to abandon them to that? Did we really want to see what is a very malign country, not people, but state under the current and previous leadership? I argue no. And so that's why I don't think it was a mistake. Now, you could follow up if you're a horrible, nasty journalist guy by saying, was it a price worth paying? I'm not sure there's an answer to that.
Yeah, well, I hadn't thought of that one, so thanks for suggesting it. I'll try it on some other guest.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because if you say yes, you say, oh, well, you as a Brit are prepared to sacrifice all those thousands of Ukrainians, which I'm not. If you say no, well, you shouldn't have ever done it then. That's what I mean. I'm not sure it's answerable. I think it's a question to put to a Ukrainian.
Yeah, and so I suppose with the... With the challenges, let's focus then on that point that you made, that NATO is a defensive organization. You said a little while ago that despite this history of Russia being invaded from the West, NATO didn't pose a threat to it. I mean, was there a better way of dealing with the diplomacy, with the foreign relations assure Russia of what the purpose of NATO was?
Well, I stand by the comment that it wasn't a state, because it wasn't NATO that invaded Russia. You know, it was Napoleon in another time, and it was the Nazis in another time. It wasn't a democratic Germany, which is, you know, virtually a pacifist nation these days. Nobody has any intentions of invading Russia. Especially democracies don't have that intention. China, give it 20 years in Siberia, who knows? But yes, I think we could have gone further in our assurances and reassurances, but we did invite them into the Partnership for Peace. They did open an office in NATO headquarters in Brussels. We did invite them for all sorts of weapons inspections, but mistakes were made. I think we could have gone further. Treaties were allowed to lapse. Conventional forces in Europe treaty, for example, intermediate range missiles treaty, they were allowed to lapse, increasing. We could have joined, we could have got the places like Poland into NATO, but with an agreement with Moscow. No, not with an agreement, because they do not get a vote in our club. With assurances to Moscow that, well, look, Poland's in NATO, we're going to stand by Article 5, but we don't think it's necessary to put any long-range or heavy weaponry up to a certain level in there. We did agree to one or two things, such as troop levels, but they mothballed a lot of heavy kit, which made the Russians nervous. So we could have done more, but I just think that Russia has been on this trajectory for forever.
Do you think the challenges Russia has found in invading Ukraine, particularly the north of the country, where the terrain I understand is a bit more troubling, could that conversely provide it some assurances about how unlikely it would be that, history has shown how difficult it is to make serious headway into Russia.
Yeah, General Winter first made his appearance in he was called General Frost then. It was a cartoon, a British cartoon in 1812 when Napoleon was on the way home in that absolutely catastrophic defeat. I think they lost something like 80% of their forces. But it's always been a factor. The factor this time was that there was a very late freeze, and they needed the freeze because when you get above Kiev into Belarus, you're into the Priapet marshes. And for that, if you're going to put heavy mechanized tanks and things across, you need the ground to freeze. And it was very late. And so it froze. So they had this short window before the spring came, and they used it, but it didn't freeze that much, and they did get bogged down. Down south, it is A, flatter, and B, drier. So they have had more progress there. But yes, that would be a restraining factor. But I don't think it's really factored into NATO's thinking, because NATO have never had strategies to invade Russia. They've only ever had strategies to defend along certain lines east of Belarus.
Now, I know this.
Sorry, west of Belarus. That's very important. West of Belarus.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, I was absolutely about to pick you up on that. I know this concept of the multipolar world is a very important one to you. So, maybe you could sort of explain a bit how that balance of power has shifted.
Well, I suspect you guys know it by different terms. For example, the term you hate the most, volatility, which, you know, it's a horrible phrase, I know. Uncertainty is another one, but it has created a more uncertain world. After the Cold War, we are still dealing with the aftermath, whether it's Azerbaijan and Armenia fighting a war a couple of years ago, or shifting alliances, or indeed what is happening in Ukraine, what happened in Georgia, all the rest of it. That is still the knock-on effects of the ending of the Cold War and the lid coming off all those frozen conflicts. But the other thing that happened is that because you don't have this discipline of the bipolar world, where 8 times out of 10 you fall into line behind the leader of your pole, which is either the Americans or then the Russians, you start acting on your own. Azerbaijan, other countries. Turkey being a good example. And so when it's a multipolar world, you've got all these different actors, all striving and reaching out in their own ways to achieve what they can. And it results in this volatility we've seen, which of course has a knock on economic effects, pretty bad ones. I mean, the Ukraine being the ultimate example now of those knock on effects. I think, as you know, I am arguing and have been arguing for some years that we will go back to bipolar, this time China, America, and people falling in behind them. I was arguing by the end of the decade, Ukraine has accelerated a bit. I think we've already seen the outlines of it emerging.
And the sort of defining contrast of the previous bipolar world was sort of communism versus capitalism. Mm. Is it democracy versus autocracy now?
Yes. This is in the latest book, Power of Geography. I mean, Biden came out with a version of it last summer at the G7 in Cornwall. He began talking about something that in my world we'd been discussing a few months. And, you know, in the sort of really dull geopolitical world think tanks, of which I am sort of a looker at, I'm not a member of, things bubble around and phrases pop up, and then you see them coming out in the media a few months later. And the D10 is one of them, Democratic 10. And Biden's idea, and that's all it is that the democratic industrialized nations of the world have to stick together. And that's the 21st century concept of the West, which is, I've argued, an outdated concept, because we now are in there with Japan, with South Korea, with India to a lesser extent. Certainly got to bring Australia in and the European democracies. And they're all in it together. And you've seen in the response to the Ukraine with the sanctions on Russia, it was just as important to get Japan on side as it was to get France on side. And Japan did indeed, has supported the sanctions. So this the 21st century, as you say, is less West-East, less democracy-communism, because the Chinese have only ever been pretending anyway. It's a very weird format. It is communism in that the party dictates everything, but it's state red in capitalist tooth and claw capitalism, communism with Chinese characteristics. But they are an authoritarian state, and so the D10 or whichever configuration you want up against the authoritarian states. And we have advantages and disadvantages. One of the advantages we have is that we're us, and we do actually believe in our values. And despite all our incredibly long list of faults, most of us live better than people live in the authoritarian states. Our weakness is that we no longer go to countries and dictate overt terms with threats, whereas the Chinese just go in and say, sell us that. Let us open that mine. You can do what you like with your own population. It's no concern of ours. Whereas we start putting in things like good governance, and I'm glad we do, but it's harder to get contracts that way.
Okay, Tim, that's been absolutely fascinating. Well, you could obviously carry on talking for hours.
what makes you say that?
So really, really fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks also to all our listeners. Hopefully you've enjoyed hearing the wisdom of Tim Marshall. And hopefully you'll be joining us again for a future edition of the Bruin Podcast.